executed in the sense of secularizing Judaism, but he was at least trying to save the Jewish content.
I think he tried.
Of kind of moral life or cultural life.
Yeah. I think it would be more appropriate to say that he tried to intellectualize Judaism.
I see.
I'm sure his intention was not to secularize, although I think that was one of the consequences for some people.
Yeah.
That is his redefinition of God,
his
process, etc.
Right, right.
And
but people
but
who
his book on Judaism as a civilization was a phenomenal book.
Yeah.
I mean, that developed this had great conceptual power in terms of the unity and the pluralism of the Jewish people.
Yes.
Democratic pluralism.
Yeah.
And that was his reaction to Horace Kallen's democratic pluralism.
Uh-huh.
Kallen and John Dewey.
Yes.
Who were dominant figures.
Yeah.
In terms of philosophical pragmatism and social.
Kallen was a complete secularist. As far as I understand,
In fact, he wrote a book called Secularism is the Will of God.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. All I knew was his little book on Job as a tragedy. It would be quite inappropriate. And my father knew Horace Kallen for some reason.
He also
admired him tremendously.
Made very important contributions.
Yeah, yeah.
Sometimes more is caught than is taught.
Yeah.
I mean, there's something about personal commitment sometimes that comes through.
Yeah.
That are really the essence of a person.
Yes.
And the other intellectual.
Yeah, much more.
Superstructures.
Yeah.
God knows what some of the motivations are for those superstructures. Sometimes position, power, authority. So you have to. I learned a long time ago. You have to really see beneath appearances in order to make judgment.
Yeah.
What people do, what they do in difficult times, what they do in celebration moments.
So would it be fair to say that JTS was really predominantly Kaplanian in the 1940s and early 50s? And then there's a kind of Talmudic Lithuanian
level,
subculture.
That was Lieberman.
Yeah, right.
Lieberman and H.L. Ginsberg, who was then retiring.
Yeah.
There was that dialectic going on.
Yeah, so that was the main ethos of the institution in those years.
And that's very good. I mean, that's what I think, it's that dialectic.
Yes.
Which dominated the culture of the seminary.
Yeah.
And Heschel had to try to find his way.
Yeah.
In between that.
Yeah, it's so important for me to realize because JTS represents much more of a traditional institution, religious institution to me, as I see it. But people who would go to JTS would still want to become rabbis rather than social workers or communal leaders. Is that so?
Well, I think this needs to be understood. Seminary, certainly my class, and actually a good number of classes, consisted of yeshiva dropouts.
Mm.
My class was probably 85% yeshiva bachor.
Ah, well that's the main difference between that and HUC.
In those days.
Yeah, in those days, the 40s.
There has been a change since that time. Let me make the point first.
Sure, please.
Yeshiva bachor, who went through all of these very deep intellectual, spiritual conflicts, at Yeshiva University or some other university, came to the seminary to sort themselves out, sort out their conflicts. And in the process, there was an extraordinary amount of rebellion against the tradition, which they found repressive in Yeshiva. When the tradition began to appear to be some imitation of Yeshiva or repetition of Yeshiva, there was rebellion against that. Why Heschel had difficulty at the beginning. Because he represented a kind of clone of yeshiva traditionalism.
Really? How so?
Well, he was an Orthodox Jew.
Yeah.
Very observant Jew. While he taught in intellectual terms, philosophy, mysticism, or ethics, there still was the feeling that he was connected with East European yeshiva life.
Oh.
the academic life in Berlin,
yes,
but also East European yeshiva life. I mean, I think in that transition generation.
Yeah, I mean, rote learning?
No, it wasn't rote learning as much as a preoccupation with the classic Jewish ideas. God, mitzvot, covenant, God's pathos, I mean, all of the themes of his book, as he was elaborating at that time, there was always some hesitation in committing oneself, because one felt, I've been through that. That's part of my problem, too. I've been through that in yeshiva.
Yeah.
In fact, our class, we were very tough Talmudic students, because most of our students were very good in Talmud. They thought they knew it all. And that's why Lieberman, who was such a tough son of a bitch.
Yeah, he was, yeah.
He was brutal with me.
Uh-huh.
He almost destroyed me. Because he would walk into the class like some commando.
Yeah.
And he would walk into the class before you sat down. He would say, Tannenbaum, read. And just open up the book and read. Read the text and explain the text. Whether you prepared or hadn't prepared. And he would go around the class like that. And he was a tough disciplinarian and was brutal with the students. And I was young and sensitive, and I could not understand a professor like that.
What do you think he was trying to accomplish with that type of demeanor?
Part of it was to establish the toughness and the discipline of the halacha. That this is not just another course.
Yes.
This is the course.
Uh-huh, yeah.
And if you don't learn this at the seminary, you learn nothing of any value.
Mm-hmm.
So he was that kind of a sergeant major.
Yeah. Did he walk that way too? Or
he was very vigorous, very energetic.
Mm-hmm.
Very energetic. Privately, he was more friendly.
Mm-hmm.
But I felt brutalized by him the first day he walked into class. And I began trembling coming into his class.
Yeah.
You know, even when I prepared. And the funny thing was, I was a good Talmudic student in yeshiva. And even when I went to Cheder in Baltimore, I hear people tell me that why a Rebbe in Baltimore said I was the best Talmud student in the class.
Mm.
I can't even remember that anymore because of Lieberman.
Yeah.
Lieberman made everybody feel inadequate.
Yeah. You didn't study with Soloveitchik.
I took some classes with Soloveitchik.
Really?
Sure.
What was he like?
Soloveitchik was like an old-time European maggid. He just got up, gave a lecture for 2, 3, 4 hours.
Yeah.
People sat and took notes.
Yeah.
And felt privileged to sit at the dust of his feet.
Yeah.
Occasionally somebody would ask a question. But it was like listening to a lecture both on the Talmud, Maimonides, and Aristotle.
Yeah.
He was a great Aristotelian.
Yeah.
So, it was a very interesting class. I used to ask myself, so what does all this mean?
So that's, you weren't reading books for him? For Soloveitchik?
No.
You're just listening?
Yeah, well, we would sit with the text. We would sit with the Talmudic text.
Oh, I see, yes.
But I only studied with Soloveitchik during the course of some summer months. Because that was the period of transition when I began making the decision that I wanted to leave yeshiva, try for medical school.
He was charismatic at that time, wasn't he? He had become a great leader.
Yeah. So everyone, there was all reverence for him.
If you were susceptible to his type of example or authority, you might have hooked on to him.
I maintained a friendship with Rabbi Soloveitchik through the 1960s.
Hmm.
In fact, during the Vatican Council, I became very close to him.
Hmm.
And I brought Heschel and him together. Wolf brought Heschel and Soloveitchik together. It's one of the untold stories of Jewish involvement in the Vatican Council, too. I wanted to make sure that we had the approval, at least the understanding, of the best and the brightest in Jewish religious intellectual life.
Yes.
And so, another chapter, every document we prepare for the Vatican, Cardinal Bea's Secretariat, I showed to Heschel, Soloveitchik, Freehoff in Pittsburgh. Nelson Glick looked at some of them. Dr. Belkin at Yeshiva.
Mm. It's hard to believe that you could get any document through all those people.
They're one on one.
Yeah.
Never the committee.
Yeah.
One on one, and always ask them for their opinion.
Very interesting. And then you just.
And what we what when they had something to say that was relevant, we incorporated that.
Very interesting.
That.
Yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, the upshot of to get back on the track.
Yes.
So Heschel's book began to be the takeoff point. It took until he published some of the subsequent works, but in the 50s, I think what really launched him onto the national scene as a unique Jewish spokesman, scholar of status, was the 1960 White House Conference on Children and Youth, the 1961 White House Conference on Aging. I was, in those days, I was the executive vice president of the Synagogue Council of America, which represents all the major religious bodies.
Is Henry Sigmund?
Henry was. He succeeded me.
Yes.
As once removed, he succeeded me.
But is he still...
No, he's with the American Jewish Congress.
Oh, I see. I see. Right. Because I met him, I guess, when he was with the Synagogue Council.
Yeah.
Right. That was 20 years ago.
Yeah.
At least.
I was succeeded by a fellow named Hyatt.
Yeah.
He didn't stay very long. And Henry Sigmund came in.
Yeah.
Sigmund was good.
I love the guy.
He's a very, very shrewd, very shrewd guy. In any case, by virtue of being the director of, in effect, all of the religious movements, I was invited as a counterpart to the Catholic Bishops' Conference and the National Council of Churches to serve as a vice chairman of the White House Conference on Children and Youth, Catholic, Protestant, Jews, of the Holy Trinity. So we met at the White House, given the charge. We made plans for the conference, and we had meetings regularly, planned a program for the White House Conference. And there was a desire to really make this a major event, because the feeling was the problems of children and youth had been neglected. There was great need for studies and legislation, et cetera. At one of the program meetings, I served on that committee with my Catholic and Protestant counterpart. Monsignor Sullivan was asked to recommend a Catholic speaker. Reverend Vallone, the Lutheran, was asked to recommend a Protestant speaker. And I was asked to recommend the Jewish speaker for the plenary session.
Mm-hmm.
The major plenary session.
Yes.
Well, after my experiences with Heschel on The Earth is the Lord's and Man is Not Alone, God is the Church of Man, because I had contact with him, even though they went to Farrar, Straus, and Giroux afterwards, Farrar, Straus in those days, Farrar, Straus, and Young, I developed a friendship with Roger Straus. And he'd asked me to help out with Heschel's book or Heschel's other books.
And when was that, approximately?
In the 50s.
Yes.
You have to look up the dates. There is a chronology.
We can clean that up. Yeah.
I came to Heschel in, 59. During the year preparation for the White House Conference. And I told him about the conference, and I said there'll probably be an audience of a minimum of about 4,000 or 5,000 people here. The chance you perform a very great mitzvah to make an impact in terms of what Jewish values that Jews have to contribute to the healing of the nation and children and youth, etc. Heschel said, sounds very important, but I don't think I can do it. I'm not sure that this is my cup of tea. So I said, you began saying that about the earth is the Lord's at one point.
Mm-hmm.
And your other book, you're not doing yourself justice.
In what respect do you mean that he was reluctant to...
Well, he was anxious about the earth as the Lord.
Yeah.
He knew it was going to be suddenly a controversy.
Yeah.
He was scared about having battles over it.
Oh, I see.
Being attacked, as happened later on.
Yeah. Because he didn't want to be humiliated.
He didn't want to be controversial. Also, he was really still quite insecure.
Yes, yes.
He was not established.
Yeah.
He saw himself as a small refugee scholar.
Yeah.
Who was here by the grace of a few people who were nice to him.
Yeah.
He had no... His sense of self-worth had been battered a great deal.
Yes, that's very important to know. Yeah.
And at least that's how I read him.
I think so. Even from his early youth.
Yeah, well, that much I didn't know about.
Yeah.
But
certainly the process of emigration is just devastating. Absolutely devastating, even under the best conditions.
Yeah. I knew when I had to move from 8th Street up to here. It was complicated.
Yeah.
The upshot of it was I went, when I saw he was resisting it, I mean, he really was frightened.
Yes.
The big mistake I made was that you would have an audience of 4,000 or 5,000
people. Yeah, I see.
And part of it, frankly, I think he also felt because he spoke with a Yiddish accent.
Yes.
Spoke as if he were davening.
Yes, his kind of sing-song tone.
Yeah.
Yes.
That he would not be understood and possibly ridiculed.
So he was aware that many people had difficulty understanding him when he spoke English? Is that what you're saying? Because I do kind of ask that question because, you know, I had trouble understanding him often.
I think he was aware of there was some limitation there.
Yes.
And I think often that's why he relied on written texts.
Yes.
To make sure he had his ideas together.
Mm-hmm.
And could communicate them. And, of course, he would not have to reach for a phrase.
Yes.
Although when he did that, he could be magnificent.
Magnificent, yeah.
The upshot of it was, to make a very long story short, when I saw he was resisting it, I was persuaded that he was the Jew for that occasion. But his feeling for moral and spiritual values, his understanding of cultural phenomena, so penetrating. Mm. So I went to Wolf Kellman. I said, Wolf, this is an extraordinary opportunity, and he's resisting it, and I need your help. So we both went in together to see him. I mean, we literally twisted his arm.
Yes.
We persuaded him. He said, well, let me try it out. And the next time I came up, a couple weeks later on, he had on his table all the sheets of paper.
Yeah.
And little phrases, children, youth,
morality,
this, that, barbershop, rock music, and he was moving stuff around.
Right.
He came to the Conference of Children and Youth, the place where it was between the session.
Where was this held?
In Washington.
In what kind of
in
building?
In a hotel.
Uh-huh, I see.
Art convention hotel.
Yeah.
The president had been there at that time. He made a speech and left. Eisenhower.
Yeah.
And Nixon after that.
Yeah.
Not about session. Nixon had received the whole delegation of speakers. I got a picture of that somewhere around there. Heschel was not in that photograph. So Heschel got up, and in his sing-song way, began reading his paper on children and youth.
Mm.
He was the hit of the conference. Mm. Had a standing ovation, 4,000 or 5,000
people. Amazing.
He absolutely blew their mind. And you read that paper, it's as if he's talking about today.
Yes.
All the moral crises
of
young people, the challenges, the corrosive effect of aspects of American culture, the hedonism, search for values and meaning, the absence of resources to deal with that, a standing ovation. And that launched Heschel.
Yeah.
He was covered in papers all over the country. His paper was handed out, people began screaming for his paper.
Yes, yes.
They had to announce it was going to be published, as it was in the volume of papers on the conference. And then he had an enormous sense of relief, and then was pleased with himself.
Yes.
And then said to me, "You did it." I didn't want to do it.
Yes.
But you made me do it. I did it.
Yeah.
And I think it was important, don't you think so?
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful. Because he often needed to get support and people to tell him that it was successful. Whatever what he wrote or what he spoke about, he needed that.
Wolf and I actually became, I guess, among his closest,
yeah,
in some ways, disciples.
Yeah.
Because we both understood his predicament in the seminary. You know, he was living in a hostile environment.
Yes, yes.
And there were a lot of efforts to contain him. I think mainly because some people, recognized what an extraordinary talent he was.
Yes.
And that he had a gift of communication,
yes,
that they didn't have.
Right.
Gift of writing, and even in speaking.
Yes.
And as in university world often, with all the prima donnas,
yeah,
he began to climb up that ladder of acknowledgement.
Yes.
Some of them who have been there 25 years never achieved.
Yeah. How would they try to inhibit him or keep him down? Or limit?
Well, I mean, first of all, often it was done in a very intellectual way. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I got a mysticism that's not really mainline Judaism. It's like a boutique.
Yeah.
That's not the department store. And we're the department store, he said.
Yeah.
It's a nicety. But it was like the old Hasidic Mishnagic struggle in Europe,
mm-hmm,
that went on, a version of that. A part of it was very personal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who's this upstart?
Yeah.
He comes here as a refugee, and he comes here from a reformed seminary.
Yeah.
And suddenly he's becoming the spokesman of conservative Judaism.
Yeah. So they kind of reproached him for being at HUC for a few years?
Well, all kinds of scuttlebutt.
Just for the sake of kind of rhetoric, not for any substance.
It was simply to undermine his credibility.
Yeah.
Undermine his acceptance and credibility. It was not vicious. It was often, as academic exchanges are, elegant.
Yeah.
Which made the thrusts all the more cutting.
Mm-hmm.
I also expected more and better from people who were preaching morality and ethics and codes of law and honor. You see, when their personal ambitions,
yes,
or egos are tread on, behave like any other animal.
That's right.
At one point, his secretary was taken away from him later in the year.
Who was that? Was it a person, a specific person?
Or he had a secretary. The seminary provided a secretary,
yeah,
for him.
Do you remember who that was?
No, Wolf does know.
Rabinowitz?
I don't know. Wolf,
yeah.
Wolf knows that.
I see.
I don't remember that. I mean, there was an effort to contain him at one point,
yeah,
in the 60s when we were working in the Vatican Council. I sent up my personal secretary.
Huh.
To take his notes.
You don't remember when his secretary was taken away?
It must have been in the 60s, around.
I see.
60, could have been around.
That's incredible.
64, 65.
Yeah.
66. Wolf knows all of that.
Yes.
And he lived through all of that. The experience was repeated in 61. White House Conference on Aging.
Yes.
He went through the same rite of passage. He resisted wanting to do it. I said, "Mr. Heschel, you know, you've now had the experience of the White House Conference,
yeah,
Children and Youth. You saw what a mitzvah gedolah that was, and a great, great mitzvah you performed. I mean, you brought honor to the Jewish people,
sure,
and to Jewish tradition. There is another opportunity to do that, and it's another national platform on the other great problem of America.
Yes.
The graying of America."
What kind of excuses did he give?
Well, he doesn't know the problem. He would have to study it. He's not sure whether he has anything to say about it. I said, Jewish tradition not having to say about honor for the elderly?
So you
say about Tokum before the elderly shall rise up in reverence and awe. So again, though, I went to Wolf because I wanted to make sure that when I would leave there, because I'd go back to my office downtown, Wolf was there on the spot every day and saw him every day.
Yes.
That there would be a continuous feeding of that decision to say yes to work. So I went to see Wolf, and we came in together again, and we became like the Smith brothers.
Mm.
And we applied our medicine. He accepted.
Yes.
And he wrote a paper.
It's a wonderful paper.
Absolute gem.
Yeah. It's a wonderful paper.
Gem.
He was writing the prophets during the same period. Did you have any awareness of that?
No, I knew he was writing it.
Yeah.
Occasionally he would give me a chapter to read.
Yeah.
He asked me to read a chapter on pathos and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
But I felt very strongly that given his potential, I mean, it was not really a personal thing, I felt the Jews needed a help.
Yes, yes. That's true.
Because nobody else was surfacing.
Okay.
I mean, my reading in my work in the interreligious community, something which the Jews to this day have never understood, especially in